It's day 19 of the partial federal government shutdown. 800,000 workers across 9 cabinet departments are affected by the lapse in funding. One of those impacted is the Interior Department, which oversees the National Park Service. Services have been reduced at parks across the nation, with only essential staff working without pay. And that's the case at one of Hawaii's most prominent attractions, Pearl Harbor. The Pearl Harbor Historic Site is being kept open thanks to the efforts of 4 local nonprofits. The group has contributed funds and manpower to keep the park fully operational. Eileen Utterdyke is the president and CEO of Pacific Historic Parks, one of the nonprofits helping to keep Pearl Harbor open during the shutdown. She spoke with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about that effort.
The impact of the shutdown was that all the national parks were basically closed because there was no funding to keep them open. When the parks closed, one of the options that's given to cooperating associations like Pacific Historic Parks or other partners that help the national parks run their parks is for them to help fund and make a donation to that park so that the park can remain open. What the national park does is that they look at what is actually needed in order to be successful at keeping a park open. And the first thing that you have to understand is there are different kind of parks. There are parks that are hiking parks, walking parks, parks that are open to the public. There are no boundaries. There are not necessarily gates and fences that keep people out. And there are also parks like Pearl Harbor. And World War II Valor in the Pacific at Pearl Harbor is a memorial. And so what that means is it's a park that is actually blocked off by a fence, and it has a number of artifacts and items that need to be preserved and protected. In addition, it is a memorial where people have died at this park, and there are people who are buried there. And so it's a different kind of park. So for us, we were given the opportunity to donate to the government for the National Park Service to keep this park open. And in order to do that, what the National Park does is they determine what they believe is essential personnel. What are the number of individual rangers that are necessary to keep the park open and keep it in a secure and safe environment? So if you were to compare this park with others, non-essential personnel is defined differently. So for Pearl Harbor, it's defined as our law enforcement, our facilities, our maintenance people, and a number of other people that is essential to keeping the park open. And so what the park did was evaluated what that would be and who that would be, and then for everybody else, whether they were on vacation, sick leave, or basically just furloughed because they were not considered essential for this basic operation. Pearl Harbor has basically a gateway. It's a gate that you walk through in order to enter this park. And as you do that, it is also a gateway that takes you to 3 other nonprofits. They're not part of the park, but they're either attached or very close to it. So our three partners that are also nonprofits are the USS Bofin, the USS Missouri, and Pacific Aviation, Pearl Harbor Pacific Aviation. So those are 3 other nonprofits that would be directly impacted if this park closed. And so the 4 of us, the 3 of them plus myself as nonprofits, got together, and we are trying to make every effort to keep the park open.
What have the nonprofits had to step up and do to keep the park open?
Pacific Historic Parks is a direct partner of the National Park Service. So we're the ones that actually have the actual partnership with them. So from Pacific Historic Parks' perspective, we provide probably 14 to 15 individual employees who actually help run the park in the various aspects. And that's not including the operations that I run as an organization. It's over and above that. It's actually to run the park. So I am continuing to provide those individuals to the park in order to keep this park running. On top of that, then the rangers are responsible for a little more of the management and oversight over and above my staff. And I don't know exactly how many people are assigned under this contract, but they're key essential personnel like law enforcement, maintenance, the superintendent, and a number of other people.
And this is all being done pro bono, correct? The government is not reimbursing your organizations for the time, the labor, and the money that are going into keeping the park open?
That is correct. That is definitely correct. The actual cash that we are contributing to keeping the park open is considered a donation, and so those funds will not be returned to us in any form. My staffing is just basically a cost that I am incurring and absorbing as an organization.
And so, Eileen, do you know how much money is actually being spent above normal overhead to by these nonprofit organizations to keep the Pearl Harbor Memorial open during the shutdown?
Well, we've paid in approximately $200,000 almost right now. So it's quite a bit of money. Depending on the day, the dollar amount can change. I think in the newspapers they've talked about $18,000 for some days, $14,000 for others. We're at about $10,000 to $11,000 a day right now to keep the operations of the park open. And it's a fluctuating number because it really depends on who's on vacation, who's considered essential personnel, do they have to borrow personnel in order to cover certain areas. And so it's like a moving part. But I think it's safe to say $10,000 to $11,000 a day right now is really what we're incurring.
Well, so that begs the question, Eileen, how long will that be sustainable for your organization and others to maintain that level of financial commitment?
Yeah, this definitely is a very large commitment, especially for nonprofits. For us, we've been very lucky. We've actually gone out and asked for donations and other support that we can get, whether it's from the state or tour operators or just the general public. So Hawaii Tourism Authority awarded us a grant for $126,000, and that actually helped us for the first maybe 2 weeks of time. To cover the cost of leaving it open. On top of that, we've had a number of tour operators who have come forward and made deposits and donations for us, and that's helped us with a couple more days. We are right now at a point where the partners, the four nonprofits, are using our money in order to keep the park open, and right now we are committed to doing that through the 11th of January. We need to get together as partners and figure out what we're going to do from the 12th, if we still have funds available, if there's been other donations that have come in that will help support this. But as nonprofits, we don't really have money set aside that enables us to do this. We're taking money from programs and education that we've been planning for the year and reallocating it to this, because we feel keeping the park open is important. But there is a limit, and that limit is unfortunately fast approaching.
And the long-term solution is for the federal government to reopen and for Congress to appropriate the money to run regular operations. Can you provide any insight to our listeners about that process? Have you been working with any members of either state elected officials or members of Hawaii's congressional delegation to find some funds for the park?
We have made a number of asks. A number of the tour operators have also made an ask. We're keeping them informed of all of the decision and the process that we've made. We have not heard anything that tells us whether or not the closure will end soon, if they're advocating for us. But they all have been requesting information from us. So we do believe that they are speaking on our behalf in trying to get this resolved as soon as possible. It's a crystal ball for all of us as to whether or not the closure will end and how soon it will end. But we are out there talking to our representatives and trying to keep them informed of how this is impacting us and how it is hurting us as organizations, you know, the people who are visiting Hawaii, how it's limiting or potentially will limit people from seeing the memorial, coming to the park. And so the information is flowing.
And if there's anyone out there who wants to donate to help that cause, how can they do it?
We have a site, well, our website. You can donate at our website at pacifichistoricparks.org. There's a link that takes you into our donation site that will allow you to make donations for this.
All right, Eileen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was Pacific Historic Park's president and CEO, Eileen Utterdyke. The group has joined the USS Bofin Museum, the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum, the USS Bofin Museum, and the Battleship Missouri Memorial to keep Pearl Harbor open during the government shutdown. If you are interested in donating to the effort, again, we'll have a link posted with this story on hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today, we're taking a closer look at the history of the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, often referred to as Punch Bowl Cemetery. Now, as far back as the 1890s, officials in Hawaii were looking at Punch Bowl as a possible cemetery. But it wasn't until the 1940s that the plan took hold. The first major push came from a $50,000 congressional appropriation for a national cemetery in Honolulu. But it became apparent that $50,000 wouldn't cover construction costs, so the project was postponed. By 1947, however, Congress and various veterans organizations requested that a permanent burial site be created for thousands of World War II servicemen who had not yet been interred. So the Army revamped the old plans, and Congress eventually approved the funding, and construction began. The cemetery opened to the public on July 19, 1949, several months after the first servicemen were laid to rest there. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us the exact date when the first servicemen were interred at Punch Bowl? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
Original Buckaroo ballads, bluegrass, and western swing fill the Atherton Studio on January 12th when Patti Clayton comes to town. This Western Music Industry Female Vocalist of the Year is accompanied by her Hawaii bluegrass friends on fiddle, banjo, and bass. Get your tickets at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
On the Long View today, our contributing analyst Neil Milner talks uniforms. Morning.
Morning.
What got you started on this?
Well, it's very interesting. I follow a site that's called Journalist Resources Roundup. The Shorenson Center at Harvard University, which is interested in helping journalism improve, has a periodic listing of research on various topics so that people who write about journalists can tap into it. So they took a look at what the most popular sites were, that is, that got the most requests, the 10 most requests for 2018. First one was fake news, no surprise. The second one was school uniforms. It was the second most requested source of information. And I thought, okay, that's worth thinking about, one, because it's a little odd, and two, because it has been an issue here, not always a serious issue, but it comes up all the time in Hawaii.
Well, full disclosure, I went to a Catholic school, and I had uniforms all the way from kindergarten through high school.
Full disclosure, I went to public school so long ago, we wore powder wigs. That was our school uniform.
Okay. And then my kids also went to schools where they were in the throes of adopting this. Do we go with the uniforms or not?
Well, and that's an interesting thing. First of all, it suggests something about this place. The Department of Education, the Board of Education, has an optional school uniform thing. You can adopt school uniforms. You can You can enforce the violations of them, but it's up to you. And one of the reasons I think that it became a particular issue here was back a number of years ago when school community-based management began to become a thing where the schools and parents had more to say about certain things. Now, on the one hand, that brought in the parents. On the other hand, if you're a parent and you're now suddenly working on a school community-based thing, you discover there's not a whole lot of stuff that's easy to understand that you can, you know, you're not going to do curriculum. There's union rules or this or that. So two things began to emerge a lot. One was discussions about whether the school should have a uniform, and the other one was school schedules, which they also ultimately lost control over. So school uniforms is an emotional issue. It's an issue that lay people can wrap their heads around. And so that I think is one of the reasons that it is such an important issue in the eyes of journalists, because on the one hand, it comes up all the time. People have expectations about what it does. And like a good journalist, you want to find out, well, what does it really do? And that's what the research, the findings seem to suggest.
And there is a school here in Hawaii, a public school, that has opted.
There are some public schools. The one that I just happened to send on to you was Kaimuki Middle School. And it's quite an extensive dress code policy about what you can. You have to, the first day of school, there's a school uniform kind of thing you have to do. There's as much on the dress code about what you can't wear, what you may not wear, as is what you may wear. No hoodies, no gang colors, no wristbands, no inappropriate shirts. I think this is a fairly typical kind of approach, that there are certain things that they want you to wear for a variety of reasons, and there are certain things that they don't want you to wear for even more obvious reasons. So you have schools around here that have it, and a lot of schools in East Oahu, where I live, have the kind of T-shirt thing. You know, you have to wear the school T-shirt.
Right, the polo. The polo shirt.
Right.
The
it doesn't
shirt.
Look right. To a person driving by on a tour bus, it looks like a bunch of kids not dressed very well, slouching down Kalani on the Oli Highway, but they often happen to have the same shirt, or they may have two different colors.
Now, I know that it's one thing when you put your child in a school that already has a uniform policy, but if you're attending a school, then all of a sudden they're saying, hey, guess what? We're going to change the rules. Then it's like, oh, how much is this going to cost me?
Well, I think there's all of these issues that come up in the school thing. And I think part of the reasons, and we'll get to the findings about this in a second, part of the reasons that they come up is that they're so much tied into broader issues about child rearing, about education, about kids these days and all of that sorts of thing. And I think so one of the issues comes up is, what does it cost me? And then you have arguments on both sides. It's going to cost you less because you're going to be wearing the same thing all the time. It's going to cost you more. Then the issue comes up about individual freedom. That's all above and beyond the other issues about, does it improve things like achievement and discipline and attendance and all that sort of stuff. That's what the research is kind of focused on. The research, and there isn't any research specifically geared to Hawaii, but the international and the national research on this has looked at those kind of questions. What's the effect of school uniforms, particularly on the quality of the improvement of the student?
I know there was a sense of pride, you know, like, okay, you know, our uniforms weren't so bad, but boy, that school was really dorky.
Yeah. Well, you and I talked about this, that the kids, the young men and women, whatever age it is, will find all kinds of ways to be creative, you could put that in quotes, about school uniforms, all the way from how do you wear them, which is how do you make them more provocative and how do you annoy the administration, to other kinds of things to become sources of rivalry. But, you know, when you look at the bottom line research here, it's really pretty interesting, a little bit disappointing to advocates of school uniforms, but not surprising considering what we know about schools. So there's the one study that I decided to use the research that the roundtable used so that the journalists would be. And there's a bunch of studies there. There's one that's really quite good and involves a bunch of schools in the southwest of the United States. They're controlled and so on. And what they find out is that the only thing that seems to be related to wearing a school uniform is that middle school kids and high school kids, especially young women, are more likely to have good attendance. So, and then one other thing, which is, and this surprised them, and it's a speculative enough finding that they can only make some guesses. It's schools that have uniform policies are more likely to retain their teachers. And in a market like Hawaii, where we're losing an enormous amount of teachers every year, that might be a thing. But if you look at the basics, like what effect does school uniforms have schools on achievement and on discipline, two of the real central focus of the school uniform advocates, the study says not much. It's just there's no statistical significance. So bottom line is that it's not a there is no evidence that school uniforms definitively make students move up to the grades faster.
Better students.
Better students, even disciplinary stuff. But it's like a lot of findings in social science, especially education. You'll find things that are not quite as good as they could be, and then you look for other reasons why. And I don't remember, just very quickly, we did this show back in a ways about some other kind of school policies, incentives to send children from poor families into college. And they didn't have much of an effect. And the main reason was there are too many other things involved, too many other things you have to change. And I think this is another one of those findings. This is not going to convince people pro or against to change their mind. But there's nothing definitive here that really says, bang, it works.
Okay. Well, on a personal note, though, I mean, I was okay with wearing those uniforms. And I just remember going to college thinking, wow, I don't have any clothes compared to the people I'm going to school with.
Yeah, I thought the same thing, and I went to a public school.
All right. Okay. Thanks, Neil.
Take care.
That was contributing editor Neil Milner with our segment, The Long View, talking about uniforms and their place in our schools.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Airlines, offering nonstop service to 12 North American cities, now including Long Beach. HawaiianAirlines.com.
On today's Reality Check, we talk traffic and fees with Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Marcel Henre. He has a story that makes my pocketbook tremble. Morning, Marcel.
Aloha, Catherine. Good to be here.
So, tell us about this idea that you wrote about this morning that makes me worried.
Well, the idea that I'm kind of broaching or floating out there is a concept that you're seeing other cities around the world that have started to use, and some in the U.S. that are now considering. It's called congestion pricing. And really the idea is these would be fees that some cities charge to drive during rush hour and during peak hour, really as a way to ease the gridlock. And it's not so much those hot lanes that maybe you'll see in other places, but really where you kind of cordon off an entire area, usually a very busy downtown, and you're charging drivers at these peak rush hours to actually drive at that time. And again, the idea is to try and reduce all of the gridlock and the congestion and the headaches that we see.
So. I know it, my first reaction was, oh my gosh, you're going to pay me to be tortured, I mean, my gosh.
Or you're going to – oh, yeah.
or I have to pay to be tortured. Yeah,
you're right.
It's nuts.
Well, I would say – and this is neither – I'm just kind of floating the idea out there. And I know, of course, you're talking about paying more and – We're talking about an island with a small tax base. We're already paying for rail. We're already paying in your cars for gas fees and, you know, gas taxes and insurance and maintenance and you name it. So certainly the knee-jerk reaction would certainly be like, you've got to be kidding me. But if you kind of peel the onion and the layers back a little more, you know, there really are costs associated with just sitting in traffic, the time you lose. The gas that is wasted, the some of those indirect, you know, quality of life issues where experts, they told me if you even took 5 to 10% of a reduction of the cars during rush hour, you could see really enormous gains and benefits in terms of the speed and the time saved and all of those benefits. So really, one way to look at it potentially would be, you know, you're kind of putting a premium on the real cost of driving during these hectic times. Now, all that being said, it really is kind of a politically, certainly it's a tough sell. I bring it up in this column that I've recently launched. I bring it up just as we want to really consider ideas, if not exactly congestion pricing per se, some sort of a system that would work with Honolulu that might more efficiently regulate or control traffic so that we all have just less headaches out there.
I can see, though, if your work day, you know, is set and you don't have much wiggle room, that you're kind of stuck. If you're a 8-to-5 kind of a person, you're going to be paying that higher price. I mean, where has this been successful?
It's been very successful in London. It was first launched in Singapore, and then in London, it started in 2003. There was, as you can imagine, a lot of pushback to the idea, but they did get it through. That city, you basically pay about $16 a day in London, you know, and that's in London. It's kind of a different market. But in order to drive in the core of the city, they have seen traffic numbers plummet by about 40% in the first decade of use. They raise about $200 million annually. And there is definitely a question of equity here. Those dollars go back into transportation improvement, into public transit, into better bus use, et cetera, et cetera. So London is pretty much in its first 15 years or so has shown some pretty good results. And so now you are seeing this debate move onto American shores with places like New York, San Francisco, L.A.
I don't know. Still makes my pocketbook tremble. you haven't convinced me on this one. I'm sorry, Marcel.
Okay. Well, I'm just putting it out there.
Okay.
You know, it's an idea.
All right. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thanks, Catherine.
Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Marcel Henri. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org. It's a treasure trove of history. We're talking about the Hawaii State Archives. Did you know it opened its doors in 1906? Well, we sat down with a man at the helm of protecting what he believes are the most important documents and records in our state. We take you down to the State Archives to meet a man who loves his job. Here's Adam Jansen.
Well, I have the best job ever. I mean, it's very simple. Because the State Archives has the duty to preserve the history of the people of Hawaii. Our mission here is to acquire, collect, describe, arrange, and preserve the public archives of the state of Hawaii. And as we implement that, it really provides the foundation of the archives, and that is to protect people's rights, identity, property, and their history. And so any records produced by a government entity that addresses those four areas is of permanent value, finds its way here into the state archives, and it's our duty to preserve those records for future generations so that the people can come in and see these records, which really are their records, because this is the public archives. So they can come in and research these records and have full access to them.
There was an event recently in Brazil, a horrible fire with the museum there, and so many treasures were lost. And we would hate to think that something, you know, could happen to any of our museums here where we hold these treasures.
So that's part of why the archives is so important, because we are trained professionals that it is our duty to think about those type of cataclysmic events, fire, flood, tornado, hurricanes, tsunamis, and why we work so hard with agencies to try and pull some of these archival documents out of their offices to bring them into the archives. Because the facility that we're in here was specifically meant and built as an archival facility. It's not a standard office building. The walls here are 20 inches thick. So it is much, much more robust than a standard office building. We have a very high-end fire suppression system. It's a gas suppression system, so there's no water pipes upstairs to flood and drown the records. So in the highly unlikely event of a fire, the gas would go off and douse the fire almost immediately, because the vault area, which is immense, it holds 12,000 boxes of records, has no windows, has no doors, has very few electrical sources. So we've tried to tamp down on all potential ignition sources as well. So we've really built this facility with those types of hazards in mind on how can we best provide for the protection of these records against these types of disasters.
We just came through hurricane season, and it did dawn on me, what happens to the buildings in our historic district? What happens to Iolani Palace? What happens to the state archives?
And that is a great concern to us as well, because currently, while the building is very robust, the bigger concern in such a disaster would be the environmentals. Is if we lost our environmental controls, we keep the records at a very constant temperature and humidity, 60 degrees and 50% relative humidity, plus or minus 2 points on either side. So if we lost that, particularly in the type of a situation that you describe, would have a lot of rain, a lot of water, spikes in temperature, spikes in humidity, we would be dealing with massive amounts of mold bloom very, very quickly. And so for us, the biggest issue is not necessarily the physical damage, but the aftermath of what would happen, because the power grid is very precarious here, and we don't currently have our own power source. We don't have backup power. So we do have a request in through the governor's office that will be going forth this year to get a backup generator system specifically for the environmental controls, because our biggest concern would be that if the power goes down, we lose environmental control. And then now suddenly every little mold spore that we've, you know, tamped down over the last 150 years starts to bloom. And instead of being able to provide unfettered access to public records, we now have a public health hazard upstairs that would cost the state hundreds of thousands of dollars to have to treat.
We did see what happened with the floods at Hamilton Library, and they lost a number of treasures, I think including Prince Kuhio's personal book collection, and that was one of the biggest heartbreaks for the librarian there, was that they were not able to save everything because they couldn't get to everything in time, and they were only able to save one shelf when there were maybe hundreds of volumes. So it's that kind of heartbreak. So I imagine, yeah, you want to avoid that.
And that's absolutely it. It's water is not the damaging aspect. It's the what does the water do? Because if you can address it immediately and freeze the documents, you're okay. But over 2, over 3, over 4 days, then mold sets in, and in which case, it becomes toxic. That's why all of our important archival records are all above ground. So, they're 15 feet above ground, no windows, only one door in, behind a 6-inch thick bank vault door. So we've tried to minimize as much of that water intrusion and environmental risks as possible.
You have a lot of documents here, important, very rare documents. Everything is going digital now. So can you talk about what the archives are doing to digitize some of these valuable documents?
Well, I may be a bit biased, but I would say that we have the most important records of state here. And because they are so important, we are pursuing multiple projects to digitize some of the most important records of state government to make them accessible. Because it's one thing to call this the public archives, but it's another thing to actually make those records accessible to the public. It shouldn't be the public archives, but only for the people who live on Oahu and can get here between 9 and 4 Monday through Friday. That's not fair to the people on the neighbor islands. These are their records too. So how do we provide equal access to anywhere, anytime? What if you are physically incapable of traveling? These are your records too. Why should you not have equal access? So we're trying to leverage technology to the best advantage that we can in order to not only make these records accessible, but also to help us better preserve the records as well. Because you cannot preserve and make accessible at the same time. Because when you have temperature and humidity controlled environments, and you take the records out of those environments and give them to a researcher to look through, you're damaging the record. So you have to balance those two concerns. But if we can digitize, and when I say digitize, we're talking high fidelity, high quality digital surrogates that are equal in quality and fidelity to the originals, then we can put those originals away and ask the researchers to look at the digital, particularly when the originals are very fragile and require very special handling. And then we can also make those digital surrogates available on the internet so that anyone, anywhere, anytime, 365 days a year from the comforts of their home, can then do research on any topic that they choose to look at their records.
I have used that library system to look up things about the palace and about Princess Kaʻiulani, and it's fabulous because you can just be on a computer anywhere and look that stuff up.
So, and we understand what an incredible asset that is. So we're really focusing on those records that a majority of our researchers come in to use. And so that is starting with the two biggest researcher bases, genealogy and land research. So a lot of our focus over the past 12 months have been on scanning our genealogy resources. And so we've done our genealogy books. There's 52 of those that trace family lineage all the way back to the very beginning. We are scanning all of our tax assessment records because in the very beginning of recorded history for Hawaii, there weren't really a lot of marriage, birth, death records because that wasn't something that was done at the time. But government taxation, well, the government sure liked to tax everybody, so there were tax records. So that was a way of finding out about your ancestors where there may not be a birth record. So those become very, very important, particularly in the 1850s. So we're scanning and indexing all of those. We have also scanned all of our land commission awards, royal patents, land surveys, foreign and native testimonies in the land recording department. And we're currently proofing all of those because we don't put anything up unless we've compared the original to the scans so that we can verify and validate that the scans we're putting up are at least of the same quality as the physical. So that the scan looks a little funny, well, it's a little dark and it's smudged in one corner, we can say, well, you know what? The original was dark and smudged in one corner too. And that every single page of the original is accounted for in the digital surrogates.
So what else? The genealogy? The land records?
The tax assessment. I am very, very happy to say that we have also scanned all of our Kalaupapa index cards. So there's 16,000 of those, and that we're having those indexed. And hopefully in the next 4 to 6 months, we'll be able to put those online so that those will be full-text search index searchable. Because that's a very, very important records that we are keeping upstairs that we want to make much more accessible, because in some instances that is the only recording of those people's existence. So we want people to have access to that part of history as well. We also did the World War I service cards because thousands of Hawaiians, almost 10,000 Hawaiians, served overseas. And so they need to be remembered as well now that we've celebrated the 100th anniversary of the armistice, the ending of World War I.
And I know you also have a donation modern Hawaiian history through the photographs of the newspapers, the Star Bulletin and the Honolulu Advertiser, which is no more.
We were very, very fortunate to get the paper photographs from the Advertiser and the Bulletin. That was an immense, immense number of boxes. And so we're still actually working through those because we just simply don't have enough space to keep. It was 350 boxes worth of photographs to keep all of those. So we're weeding out the non-Hawaii-related photographs. They didn't keep every photograph they ever took, but they kept those photographs of either individuals or events that they thought were likely to be of historical significance and likely to run again. And so they also subscribed to the AP Wire and World News. So they had a lot of non-Hawaii-related events, riots in Times Square and things of that nature. So we're weeding those out and narrowing it down to just Hawaii-related news. And so we're still in the process of doing that. We anticipate it's probably going to take another year or two because it is 350,000 photographs. So it's going to take a little bit of while to make those fully accessible, but we're getting there.
That was Adam Jansen, head of the Hawaii State Archives, and he recently brought lawmakers in for a tour hoping to make a case for improved security to safeguard one-of-a-kind artifacts and historic documents. Priceless history of Hawaii'i.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Harbor Restaurant at Pier 38, featuring Brasa Oven Cuisine and the Copper Top Bar with Harbor Views, offering private event dining options and on-site parking. HarborPier38.com.
In today's backyard quiz, we focused on the history of the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, what we know more commonly as Punchbowl Cemetery. Now, as far back as the 1890s, officials in Hawaii contemplated using a site atop Punchbowl Crater as a cemetery, but it wasn't until the 1940s that construction plans got off the ground. Congress set aside $50,000, but that wasn't enough to fund construction, so the plan languished. But by 1947, Congress and veterans organizations again pushed for a permanent burial site for thousands of World War II servicemen who had not yet been interred. After the Army took a second look, Congress approved the necessary funding. The cemetery opened to the public on July 19, 1949, but that was several months after the first servicemen were laid to rest there on January 4, 1949. That was the answer we were looking for, but we got no winners today. If you have an idea for a quiz, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. HPR's Noe Tanigawa joins us in the studio today to talk about secret gigs and intimate concerts, something called So Far Sounds, and something that was new to me.
Yeah, to me too. I mean, we all like those professional stars who can come in with giant budgets and fireworks and just stun us, right? But there's another way of being entertained. There are other experiences that are maybe less staged, less scripted, maybe more risk-taking, and maybe fresher. That's what I was looking for when I went to New York City recently, and I think I Googled something like maybe intimate gigs, and I found So Far Sounds. What this is, an international startup that connects audiences with intimate performance experiences. It started in 2009 when the founder, Rafe offer. Invited 8 people over for music to his apartment in London, okay? The idea of connecting people with others as well as all as musicians and other types of artists in a cozy setting completely took off. And, you know, it happened pretty much the same for the person who's now running So Far Sounds Honolulu, Rachel Lee. She's originally from Sacramento.
My friends are going to these events in the summertime, and I asked to go with them, and they're like, oh, it's secret. You can't come. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I looked it up on my own, and I was like, oh, I'll just go when I go back to Honolulu. And then I looked it up, and there wasn't any, but it had this link. So I just drafted something small saying why it'd be trendy, and I think people would like it in Honolulu. And then
and suddenly they chose you to be the person to do it.
Yeah. And I didn't know how much work it'd be. But it is a lot of fun. It's all about the artists. It's all about the artists playing their new stuff or just trying to experiment with new music.
Can you imagine being invited to something like that, Catherine?
Yeah.
I mean, luckily, Rachel's friend McKenna Bell jumped in, and recently Zoe Moriwaki started handling the talent. And so here's the deal. You look online for So Far Sounds Honolulu. You find the date and the town online, and you apply to go. If you make it in, they send you the exact address the day before, and you do not know the lineup until you get there. In New York City, I went to a BYOB, Bring Your Own Cushion, pet-friendly event in a pet store in Nolita. And it was really amazing. There's a guy playing pan drums, a couple of guitarists. The sets are short. There's a little talk story after each set. And for performers, I mean, this is so much better than being drowned out by chatter and you know, water feature noise there in a lobby somewhere. I mean, singer-songwriter Evan Kay performs all around town, and he also is a So Far Honolulu artist.
That feeling that you get when people really connect to your music and really connect to the message you're saying is powerful. And I experience it too little as a musician myself. So
I'm just wondering whether people have never had that experience, so they don't know to go for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. You won't know unless you try, but it's that uncertainty of making the gamble that kind of stops a lot of artists and a lot of creatives from even making that jump in the first place.
The jump to what?
To kind of putting yourself out there and to betting on yourself and your artistry and your music and your creativity that you don't necessarily know when you get into it where it's going to be 5 years, 10 years down the line.
They keep pushing, but I'm starting to slip further down than I ever thought.
So this is Evan performing. And, you know, when he played at So Far, he did his very first all-original set. And he says the reaction told him, hey, this could be a thing, you know? I mean, the question is, when do you want to support artists? And when do they need it? Right?
Right.
I mean, Evan says his following has grown because of the mystery of the whole thing. I mean, people might not sign up to go and see him, but because they didn't know, they found him. And he's discovered so many people, too. He says he's a fully booked professional musician now. He first played it So Far in 2017. When he travels, he can play the So Far circuit. And we're talking 425 cities around the world. Hyderabad, La Plata, Reykjavik, Tbilisi, Ulaanbaatar. I mean, This is kind of wild. And he knows musicians who do So Far touring around the world. It is volunteer all the way. Past venues have been the Banan Shop on University, Team Papakoleo Jiu-Jitsu Studio in Kaka'ako. They did some backyards in Kahala, St. Louis, Aina Haina. They did an empty escape room in Kaka'ako, too, some co-working hubs.
So this is kind of a grab bag pop-up
it is.
Event,
exactly.
Right?
And the hosts volunteer. And the people organizing it volunteer. It costs $15 to go, and that money is divided between the So Far Sounds organization and the musicians themselves.
I just wonder about, like, how do you get around zoning laws? But I imagine they try and keep it small and low-key.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's usually a one-off, you know, or they can go back. People who would like to volunteer their homes are interested in hosting something like this in their homes. They can just check online, though. Everything's up there. Most events are BYOB unless they're in a bar. And they're always looking for talent. You know, the performers are vetted. You know, they've got to have be established to a certain extent. They have to have a certain social media account and so on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, you know, but discovery is what it's all about. You don't want to be trapped there with somebody you don't want to hear. Now, this is Taimane. People must have been surprised when she came on up. Kimie Miner's been there. Olivia Tai's video is really fun to watch. And I heard Billy Sage blew people's minds.
Billy always does.
Well, the next So Far Sounds in Honolulu is going to be January 13th, somewhere in Kaka'ako.
Curious. Now, I just kind of wonder because, I mean, yeah, you've got to be, it's got to be better than just crazy karaoke kind of
definitely
thing.
These people are vetted. And if you'd like to check them out online, you can see performers from all over the world who are now So Far Sounds talents.
I think that's what blows me away is that it's worldwide. You know,
great way to discover people.
Right. So if you're planning a trip somewhere, that's an interesting way to get to know the city or, you know, a country.
Sure is.
So where's your next concert going to be? Or
these people?
I know you.
Who knows?
Me. When you go on your vacation, right?
I don't know what to Google next.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Noe.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Noe Tanigawa with an emerging trend here in the islands, or at least in Honolulu. We don't know if it's on the neighbor islands, but, you know, let us know. Yeah. So to read her stories about this, check out HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Yeah, that's
hundreds of billions of dollars in tariffs and a new NAFTA that's a whole lot like the old NAFTA. 2018 was quite a year in trade. So what did we learn?
I think what we've learned over the last year or so is how important trade is to agriculture and how important free trade is with our best customers.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the year of the trade war, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
That is it for today. Up tomorrow, we continue our look at the impacts of the government shutdown in the islands. Are you affected? Share your story. Call our talkback line and leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or Twitter at HI Conversation. This show and all our past ones available on The Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.